One writer's voyages in the lands of fiction and memoir.
When you're writing fiction, and when you're writing a memoir too, I mean, it doesn't really matter, nonfiction, fiction, you inevitably come down to that question. Can I really ever know another human being? And can I ever really be known by another human being on the deepest, most intimate level?
That's Russell Banks. We spend the hour with him today, first talking about his new book, a travel and personal memoir, Voyager. Then we re-air our 2011 interview with him about his novel, Lost Memory of Skin. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Russell Banks is one of America's greatest living writers. Joyce Carol Oates called him a writer in the grand tradition. Best known for his novels like Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter, his latest book is a work of nonfiction, Voyager. It mixes deeply personal memoir with travel essays spanning his journeys to the Caribbean islands of the Antilles, to Alaska and Florida, to the Himalayas. In each of these remarkable essays, Banks considers his life and the world. In Everglades National Park, this perfect place to time travel, as he calls it, he traces his own timeline, seeing more and more of his past selves each time he returns. Recalling his trips to the Caribbean in the title essay, Voyager, Banks dissects his relationships with the four women who would become his wives. In the Himalayas, he embarks on a different quest of self-discovery, challenging the limits of his endurance. I sat down with Russell Banks in June to discuss his relationship to writing, to exploration, and to the women in his life. Well, Russell Banks, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
This was a terrific book, Voyager, Travel Writings. It's really both a memoir and a travel book. You call it a kind of double helix.
Right.
Say what you mean by that.
Well, the two genres, really, travel writing and memoir, are wound around each other. And in the travel, reflection and memory, reevaluation of my life and so forth keeps coming up. And I think they create together, the essays, a kind of narrative. It's not novelistic, really, but there is a kind of recurrence of themes and issues and questions and mysteries that keep returning, even though the locales vary dramatically. I mean, from South Florida to the Seychelles Islands in the Indian Ocean to the Himalayas to Scotland and Alaska and so on. Still, it's the same narrator with, I hope, a distinctive and recognizable narrative voice, as if it were in a narrating a novel, and he's going back and forth with regard to his own life and trying to place it into the context of his travels. So they are woven together, even though originally these essays were written as travel essays, but they were more than revised, and in fact they were pretty much rewritten. For example, one of them, the longest one that's half the book, practically the title essay, Voyager, was originally about 30 pages, and now it's 120-something pages. So in order to make the rest of the essays kind of come together in a narrative form.
And it's a very powerful essay. I found it's one that really develops this theme of marriage, of intimacy, of secrets that are revealed. And it's carried out really on two levels, two planes, naturally. One is, of course, your travels throughout the Caribbean, the voyage in the Caribbean islands of the Antilles. But the other is the voyage through your marital history. And you are recounting this history to the woman who became your fourth wife.
Right. Yeah. No, the first sentence sort of gives it away. It says, a man who has been married four times has a lot of explaining to do. And so that's really the job of this long essay in some sense. But the format is that in courting the woman who would become my fourth wife, I have to describe what happened to the other three. And so that's the sort of the setup, as it were. And one has to do that anyhow. I mean, it's a perfectly realistic premise, I think. If you're trying to convince someone that it's a good idea to marry you, and you have a lot of mileage, as I did, you need to explain how you acquired that mileage. And so that's really the task of the narrator, of me and as the writer, and of this man who is courting this slightly skeptical woman. I mean, she has her own character in the course of this essay, where she questions and raises questions every now and then and says, are you talking about your father? Or are you talking about yourself? Are you talking about, you know, you, or are you talking about her? You know, who did this? Who did that? It's sort of an interrogation in a way, implied interrogation anyhow.
And your father, who does, he doesn't figure in quantity in a large way, but certainly in quality he does. Mm-hmm. Talk about why she would be confused between you and your father in this.
Yeah, because I reveal from early on what I was doing at the age of 19, 20 years old, 22 years old, was trying to avoid becoming my father and unconsciously replicating him in so many ways. And as I described my behavior at that age and everything, I was simultaneously just saying that I was doing everything I could or thought I could do in order not to replicate the kind of marriage my parents had had, which was marred by alcoholism and violence and serial adultery and so forth, and abandonment. And yet here I was, despite all, and despite those intentions, nonetheless replicating much of my father's behavior at that age.
Not really in terms of violence, but no. Yes, in terms of drinking, and also in a more... in maybe a more unusual way, in your relationship to your mother, what were you trying to do to correct about your relationship with your mother, with the women that you were involved with, the first three wives?
Well, I don't think I had a vocabulary for it at the time and or real conscious knowledge of it, but I think I was trying to find someone who was as much as possible unlike my mother, and yet I kept falling in love with women who, while superficially unlike my mother, on a deep level were very much like her. And I was repeating that kind of compulsive repetition of behavior that I think many people fall into, especially if they're coming out of a childhood that was marred or characterized by divorce and abandonment and so forth. You end up going there despite yourself. And in that case, and with regard to my mother, I was, without knowing it, I had been raised to be the son of a particular type of woman, to make her happy and to please her. And so I found women who, I fell in love with women who made me feel the same way, as though I were able to please them and as though I were the center of their universe. And only gradually did I begin to realize that I was, you know, doing this in kind of a compulsive way.
And yet you do talk about it as something you were trying to get right over and over again. What was the impact of this telling of the story of your previous marriages to your future wife? What impact did that have on your own psychological process? Did it prepare you for your new marriage?
That's an interesting question, and I'm not sure I could answer it before I was able to write this book. I think back then I was just doing what seemed to come naturally to me at that time. This was the first time I had ever been in love with a woman who didn't need me, and that was challenging in ways that I had never been challenged before. And I might add that I since then have been married now 27 years to the same woman, and it seems to have worked. Whatever took place over in that long trip through the Caribbean in 1988. But I wasn't changed by the process, I don't think. I think I probably had changed in small increments leading up to that point over the years, and was finally, in a way, emotionally mature in a way that I had never been before, and was able, therefore, to act on that and to see the truth, first of all. The truth of my own experience, the nature of my own experience, especially with regard to women, and then to be able to say the truth. And then when it came time to, many years later, to try to write about it, I think I could do it because I had already lived it to some large degree. Even if I hadn't at the time been completely aware of it, the writing about it made me much more aware of it, of course. Of this shift of consciousness, shift of understanding, greater clarity into my own personality, past, and needs.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Russell Banks about his new collection of travel essays, Voyager. It's a deeply personal mix, exploring both the external and internal journeys he's traversed in his 77 years. As a writer, one has to find one's voice, which takes a lot of courage and confidence, I think, in one's own identity. And yet, if in one's marriage one is always trying to please someone else, then there is a certain submersion of one's identity. I wonder if you could talk about the interrelationship. You know, you're writing the history of your marriage and the whole way in which you've honed your identity through that?
Well, that's a toughie. That's a complicated question to address. I do know this, and I've said it before in different ways, that writing probably saved my life and made me a useful human being as well, because it required of me a kind of rigor and discipline. It obliged me to be smarter than I am most of the time, and to be more honest than I am most of the time, and to be more open and aware than I am most of the time. When I'm usually not that smart, and I'm not that honest, and I'm not that open and aware the rest of the time. So writing provided me with that kind of discipline, order, rigor, from the beginning, and many things could have done that. I mean, there are many professions, many activities that require that same thing, honesty and intelligence and decency. But also so does a marriage require that. And so I think they are related in that sense, as you raise the two together. Question with regard to the two together, and I think that it wasn't really until I was a mature man. I was 47 when Chase and I got together, and that's a little late, I suppose, for the lights to go on. But sometimes the lights never go on, so you better be grateful when they do. But I know that by that age, I had a kind of maturity and clarity that I did not have when I was younger. And I wonder, the question makes me wonder, but I wonder anyhow, if it wasn't the writing, the process itself that gave me that maturity, because it required it. You go back to what you said about the voice, you were right, it takes a long time usually to have the confidence and the emotional clarity and intellectual trust, in a way, to to be able to have a reliable, trustworthy voice in the narrative. And that's the same thing that's required, as I say, in a marriage, too.
I was struck by a phrase that I came across in the essay Voyager, in your book Voyager, Russell Banks. You say that unlike fantasies, secrets don't lie, but sometimes memory does lie. So tell us a little bit about the context of this thought.
Well, I was talking about the burden of courting someone and that there was a distinction to be made here between the revelation of secrets and the revelation of fantasies, fantasies were essentially, on some level, they're lies. They're lies about the world. There's no attempt to validate a fantasy by checking it against reality. That's the nature of a fantasy. It's an escape from reality, an avoidance of reality. Whereas secrets, you know, when you deal with secrets, you're dealing with a reality you may not want to deal with, you may not like, because it doesn't pass it, because it's rubbing up against reality. It's an unavoidable, inescapable reality. And I think that I was talking at that point about the need in this instance particularly to make that distinction and to be sure that what I was dealing with was secrets, not fantasies.
Yeah, and yet you were also doing this on a voyage through these isles that are so much the subject of fantasies. I mean, fantasies that are in some way are killing the killing the host.
Yeah, that keeps coming back to the narrative, the dreaming up of the Caribbean. I think that phrase appears several times, how we in the northern climates and European and North American worlds have dreamed up the Caribbean in a way and have ignored the reality of the place. And that's why I come back to those restored plantation houses and so forth, where the history of slavery has been erased. And it's a sort of a Gone with the Wind fantasy about that whole, you know, 400-year aspect of the history of the place. That's an important point in, first of all, in the personal life of the narrator of the character named Russell Banks, and it's also a real point about his in this essay, but also in elsewhere in the book too. But in particular here, the relation we tend to bear and are encouraged to take toward the Caribbean. It's what's advertised, really. It's how it's promoted. Come back to Jamaica and all. In every television ad, every newspaper insert, and so forth. That's the whole idea, is to create and sustain and feed a fantasy about this place, which, for the people who live there, is not a dreamland. It's a real place with grinding poverty and with closed down futures for their children and with oppression and corruption and so on. And this account of this travel through the Caribbean really, I hope, points to that again and again and contrasts the reality against the dreamed up fantasy.
And there's also the ecological impact of tourism.
Yeah, that runs through the entire book, really, I think, but it's especially true with regard to the Caribbean and the cost to the environment of, you know, mainly of these cruise ships, too, and carrying 4,000 people on a crew of 2,000 into a small little village, you know, a seaside village, and everybody disembarking. And I mean, the impact of that is like an invading army. And you see it over and over again. I mean, some of these observations were made back in the 1980s, and so it's only 10 times worse today than it was then.
And yet you did find some places, small villages that lived as they did before. Talk a little bit about
that. There were a couple of islands that still were managed somehow, inadvertently perhaps, to have escaped the tourist trap. There was a contrasts, especially, say, on St. Martin, which is the French side, versus St. Martin, the Dutch side. And the Dutch side had been turned into a casino, essentially, and there was still, on the French side, something that was wholesome and authentic and had left over from previous era. And then the island of Saba, which had never had the plantation, the history of sugar and sugar plantation, largely because there wasn't any flat land on the island, and it was all mountain. And that, too, had escaped both, and there were no white sandy beaches. And so by the absence of the white sandy beaches and the absence of slavery, it was idyllic, really. And no tourists wanted to go there, you know. So there were little spots like that that by accident managed to escape history.
And you could have your Caribbean fantasy.
Yeah, then you could have it, right? And in fact, I did. I mean, I recount having a sudden fantasy in Saba that, oh boy, this is perfect. I can get a little guest house, and then I can learn how to cook Creole, and I can just run a little B&B here, and once a week the plane will come over with the New York Times and so forth. That crashes too.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with the great American writer, Russell Banks, about his latest book, Voyager. Now, you say that the trip was both a compulsion and a willed return trip that confused you by the conflicted emotions it evoked.
Yes, I had lived in Jamaica before in the 1970s, and that was where my second marriage kind of fell apart. And I had realized afterwards that there was, you know, it was an unhappy time in some ways, and even though it was an exhilarating time, and in many ways enlightening for me, but it was also very painful. And yet I knew I didn't really understand the ground, why the ground fell out from under that marriage. There or at all, for that matter. And so by returning to that place, to the Caribbean in general and to Jamaica in particular, because the journey more or less ends at Jamaica, I was returning to the wound, as it were. And I knew that. But I wanted to. As you say, it was willed. I was offered the opportunity to make this journey by a magazine, but it became much more very quickly than just that. And under the circumstances, because I was traveling with Chase, whom I was courting at the time, then I really needed to, I had a double impulse. One was like, I don't really want to go there. And the other was, I better go there. I have to go there.
And you say that Chase, was skeptical to a certain degree. How did she react to the revelations of maybe the more difficult or the part of that had been your fault in previous marriages and how you treated your wives?
Well, she married me.
Right, but right then. In other words, yeah. what led from her skepticism to her acceptance?
Well, I think that trust and my own honesty. I was being honest about events and behavior that I could have hidden, I could have sugarcoated, I could have avoided. And so I think that probably reassured her paradoxically and rather than threatened her. And she's a brave and independent woman, and I don't think she's easily threatened. Although she at that time had never been married before, she had managed to get to the age of when she was 37 at the time without having made the mistake of marrying badly.
Now, in 2003, you went to another Caribbean island, a very different one, Cuba. You interviewed Fidel, and so tell us about that. How was Fidel?
He was then very healthy and very much in charge. In fact, right after we left, I think within a week or so, he imprisoned some 12 journalists and then another 20 dissidents. So he was controlling the situation there, and to an extraordinary degree. I was there by a little bit by accident. I went with William Kennedy, the novelist, dear friend, and we went at the invitation of the a literary festival that they were holding in Havana. Of Latin American writers, Central and South American writers, and they invited Kennedy and me to go because we had each allowed them to translate one of our books into Spanish and distribute in Cuba, which most American writers wouldn't do or couldn't do up to that point. But we didn't care. We knew we'd never see a penny of it, but they promised to distribute it to every high school in the country and to sell it for the equivalent of a dollar. So that seemed worth it. And so they were grateful and invited us to come down and put us up. And what happened was it was the month before, it was 2003, the month before the invasion of Iraq, and Fidel was obsessed with that. And he didn't seem to believe that the Americans were crazy enough to invade Iraq. And I think he also saw and knew through his own people that Kennedy and I were somewhat left-leaning, sympathetic kind of writers who might be able to put a puff piece or something for him into the New York Times Magazine or the Washington Post. So he was trying to use us. And so he invited us the next day after a big welcoming banquet to come to his office and talk with him, which we did. But what was supposed to be a short luncheon interview turned into a 9-hour marathon, which I guess things happen like that with him frequently. And it was extraordinary because after, you know, maybe 20 minutes or so of chit-chat, he said, okay, now we're all friends. You can ask me anything you want. You can't record it, and you can make notes if you like. And Kennedy, who's an old journalist and very experienced at this, and I just started to go, and you'd ask a question, and he would respond with a speech. But even that was fascinating. And it got down to one point, I asked him, I said, after all the 47 years, is there anything you regret? And he immediately said, yes, I never should have trusted the Russians, which I thought was a wonderful confession at that time. And the other answer, he said, two things. He said, and the other one was that I thought the revolution would eliminate racism, but it didn't. He said, so we're taking a hint from you Americans. We're introducing affirmative action here. And this was right at the time when there was a University of Michigan suit being played out against affirmative action. And I knew he reads the papers, and I knew he was just jabbing me a little bit as an American. But it was a fascinating event. I'm really, really glad I had that opportunity. And then the next day he sent us off to his little secret hideaway in the Bay of Pigs, and we continued our Cuban adventure. I was just there again in December this year, 2015, because that was the 2003 was the last time before December this year, and because I wanted to compare the difference between Cuba then and Cuba now. And it was extraordinary difference. It had gone from a country that seemed where everyone acted as though they had no future. There was a kind of pessimism and bleak depression with everyone practically that you spoke with in 2003. It was replaced entirely by optimism, by a belief in the future, that things were going to get better for their kids than they were now and their grandkids, that the future held something for them. It was a really remarkable shift in just that period. And I know it had everything to do with Obama's opening it up, mm-hmm. of course.
Well, so I'd just like to ask you as a last question, with all the intimacy of this book, do you still feel, as you say in the book, that it's impossible to ever be truly known and never actually know an other?
You know, I come up against that in my writing fiction, in my novels and short stories, and I came up against that question here. It's for me, it's been a burning question really all my life, and I don't want to have to answer it the way I inevitably come down on it. when you're writing fiction, and when you're writing a memoir too, I mean, it doesn't really matter, nonfiction, fiction, you inevitably come down to that question: can I really ever know another human being, and can I ever really be known by another human being on the deepest, most intimate level? And I always come away saying, no, I don't. There is a kind of permanent solitude. We are born alone and we die alone, and I can't get around that. I'd love to get around it, but when I have to tell the truth, I can't get around it.
Do you feel that way about your characters?
Yes, I do. I mean, that's what I kind of mean is that when I get down to it in a novel, I get as close as I can and as much inside the character as I can. And maybe that is the only way I can get to know someone on that intimate level, that fuller level, is by fictionalizing them, you know. And that really isn't getting to know another person. That's, in a sense, getting to know myself better, you know.
So would you say then that memoir and fiction in a way have the same purpose?
I think they do, and I think they function very much the same way when we read them. We're taken inside a life other than our own, and given access to as much as the writer is able to make available, and we come away with deeper knowledge, certainly, of both another human being, but in the process, deeper knowledge of ourself. That engagement is what gives us knowledge of ourself. It's almost like a dialectical back and forth. I know that I know myself better for having read Madame Bovary, for instance.
Well, that's wonderful. This is just a terrific book, Voyager, Travel Writings, Russell Banks. So thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been great to talk to you.
Read an excerpt from Russell Banks' new book, Voyager, by going to writersvoice.net. After the break, our 2011 interview with Banks about his novel, Lost Memory of Skin. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today with one of America's greatest authors and a personal favorite of mine, Russell Banks. Here's our 2011 interview with him about his novel, Lost Memory of Skin. Russell Banks has long been one of my favorite novelists, ever since I read his 1989 novel, Affliction. He tells the stories of working-class people with a deep affection and respect. Unsparing in painting the struggles of their lives, he shows the strengths they reach for in response. His novel, Lost Memory of Skin, continues this tradition. It tells the story of a young man known only as the Kid. Cast out of society as a convicted sex offender, he's homeless because he can't live anywhere within 2,500 feet of where children may congregate. Despite the stain of his crime, the Kid garners the reader's sympathies. That's because he seems like basically a good guy. He cares deeply for his pet iguana, he's harder on himself than he needs to be, and he's searching for a way to become a better person, despite the attempts of society to slap him down at every turn. And we sense that his punishment is way out of proportion to his crime. But Lost Memory of Skin is about more than one young sex offender. It holds a mirror up to society itself, showing the hypocrisy that leads it to ostracize a young man like the Kid while pushing the pornographic currency of sex and violence in media and the culture. Russell Banks' main works include the novels Cloud Splitter, The Sweet Hereafter, and Affliction. Well, Russell Banks, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
This was a terrific book. I've long been a fan of yours. This is just a profoundly moving and wonderful book, Lost Memory of Skin. It's about a young man who's living a homeless life after having been convicted of being a sex offender. Before we get more into the story, though, or maybe this will get us into the story, tell us about the title, Lost Memory of Skin.
One of the central themes or contexts for the novel is that fuzzy gray zone that has come to exist between fantasy and reality, sexual fantasy and sexual reality in particular, and largely in the last decade and a half, maybe, or two decades, and largely due to the internet and to the proliferation of pornography and so forth, such that people have lost sight of that sharp line that previously seemed to exist between fantasy and reality. And so it's like a lost memory of skin, of the tactile reality, of the erotic, I guess you could say. So I think that's what I'm trying to point to with the title. And the kid, the central character in the novel, and also in his way too, the professor, the secondary character, and then many of the people that surround them, and maybe many of my readers as well, have lost the memory even of what it's like to have actual physical contact with other human beings. So I'm trying to open that up as a context for what is essentially a story of a young man on a very serious quest.
A serious quest?
Yeah. I mean, he's looking for, ultimately, meaning in his life, like most of us, but he's doing it at a very particular stage of life. He's only 22 years old, and he's, in a way, not had much of a life up to now. So he's seeking out a way to put meaning into his life, slowly and bit by bit, against tremendous obstacles.
Yeah, those tremendous obstacles being that he has been convicted of being a sex offender.
Right.
You say you were just talking about how we've lost the tactile physical contact. This book is also very much about social isolation.
Yeah.
We start out the book, he's living in a place under a causeway with other sex offenders because there's no other place for him to live.
Right. Yeah, that's actually based on an event you may be familiar with from the press a few years ago in Miami. It turned out there was a whole colony, in a way, of convicted sex offenders living under the Tuttle Causeway, which connects the mainland to Miami Beach in Miami. And it happened as a result, an unintended consequence of laws that were passed in Florida and South Florida, particularly, that prohibited sex offenders from living anywhere within 2,500 feet of any place where children gathered, schoolyards or child centers or even playgrounds or libraries or anything like that. And so that meant, in a sense, that they couldn't, in a real sense, that they couldn't live anywhere in the city. And so the parole officers and police and city officials started just dropping these guys off there and leaving them to their own devices. And pretty soon they had built an encampment and had become a community. And I was just sort of taken by that, and taken by the awful dark irony of it, and then the unintended consequences of these laws now, which are proliferating all across the country, and little colonies like this are starting to pop up everywhere, and it has a lot to do with the kind of fear and even panic that we're going through as a culture, really, with regard to child abuse, sexual child abuse, and sex offending.
At the same time that pornography is proliferating.
Yeah, yeah, right. And at the same time we're using sex in every possible way to sell consumer goods. And it's almost a diabolical situation. And I don't think that we've looked at it awfully closely. I mean, I've sort of studied the literature, and there are a few figures out there who have made a serious investigation of it, and are dealing with it, and I think some politicians are, but most people don't dare speak of it, and don't dare speak of it in any critical way.
Well, yeah, I mean, the kid here, he's 22. His offense, such as it was, occurred when he was 17.
No, it actually occurred when he was 20. Well, it had occurred recently. He's 23 at the opening,
Oh, okay.
and it occurred when he was 22, but
Oh,
with a girl who was 14.
That's right. So he was 22
Right.
With a girl, although you say with a girl who was 14, he
Right.
actually didn't actually do anything.
No, but he solicited her on the internet, and or maybe she solicited him. It's not quite clear. And he ended up trying to meet her, clearly for a sexual encounter. And that's what he got turned in for.
Right. So this is a very complicated situation, and I don't know how much you want to reveal
No, it's about as much, I think, at this point,
Okay.
yeah.
All right.
In that regard, yeah. Happy to talk about any number of aspects, but you don't want to give away the whole plot.
Absolutely. But it still, nonetheless, seems that he hardly would have passed for a sex offender in the past.
That's right.
What's really going? I mean, he is a sex addict.
Right. He's a pornography addict, yeah.
But is he a sex offender?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you know, we have these draconian laws now that bunch everybody in together, serial rapists alongside, you know, a high school boy who's over 18 with a high school girlfriend who's under 18 having sex to some poor old sad drunk, you know, urinating in a parking lot. They're all put in the same bag. Socially, in terms of their relation to the rest of the community, they're turned into marginalized lepers, basically, who we don't want to think about.
And he's especially vulnerable because he,
yeah.
in some ways, has been isolated
right.
always. Talk
right.
a little bit about that.
Yeah, he's like an awful lot of kids who grow up, you know, barely literate, single parent who's too distracted, busy, or depressed or whatever, to provide anything like support or protection. So he's essentially raised himself, a latchkey kid, I guess we used to call them. But the numbers are enormous. So he's not, you know, unique in any way, and he's not even atypical in many ways. And he's a loser. He's a kid who walks into trouble, or trouble finds him, not because he has bad luck, but he's basically got no real survival skills in this complicated world.
Well, what also comes across, though, is how likable he is, how basically decent he is.
Well, I'm glad. I hope that comes across, because it's really hard to get engaged by a character with his particular sociological characteristics, unless he's got an attractive voice and an attractive wit and mind about him, and I think he does. I think he's intelligent. I think he's funny. He has an angle on things that's irreverent and humorous, and so I found him wonderfully engaging myself, or I wouldn't have been able to spend 3 years with him writing the book.
We're talking with Russell Banks, novelist Russell Banks, about his latest book, Lost Memory of Skin. He's also very caring, especially about his iguana.
Right, his animals. You know, it starts with his that's the first and perhaps the only creature he's ever loved, and is this long, what is it, it's about 30-inch long iguana who becomes very dear to him and intimate. It's his companion and his only companion.
Now, we won't talk more about Iggy the iguana, but as you say, his animals.
Well, he's on the cover, so that.
Oh, yeah, okay, we can
he's
talk.
Very central.
He is.
Iggy the iguana, yes.
He is. Now, at a certain point, you say the police have dropped these men off who have no place to live because, you know, with overlapping circles of 2,500 feet, there are kids everywhere.
Right.
But then there's a raid, and their encampment is completely torn up by the police. Why did you put this in?
This, too, is based on real events as well, because it became sort of a scandal once the public got wind of it and politicians started railing against the encampment, and so, you know, just before election day, it got raided, and then they tried to move them around into the city, and there was no place, you know, it was not in my backyard kind of situation, and eventually they all drifted back.
Then you introduce another character, the other main character, who is fascinating in his own right, possibly not quite as likable.
Yeah.
The professor.
Right. Yes, the sociologist who's making a study of convicted sex offenders and the homeless convicted sex offenders and the social phenomenon of that. He's obsessed with it in his own way, and his relationship with the kid becomes very interesting, I think, and complicated, because the kid is a subject for his study on the one hand, and on the other, he's engaging the professor personally. The professor likes him, finds him endearing in many ways. And so the two of them gradually create a bond between them, an unlikely bond in some ways, perhaps, but one that allows both the professor and the kid to tell their stories to each other.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Russell Banks about his latest book, Lost Memory of Skin. And the professor, even though he's, you know, supposedly the most intelligent man in the whole area, and he's got this, honors up the wazoo, is also incredibly socially isolated. Talk about his social isolation. How is that both similar to and different from that of the kid?
Well, he's isolated partly because he's morbidly obese. He's a man who can't stop eating. He's devouring the world in a way, and so he's an enormous man, and that has isolated him from other people, both visually and physically, and in some of the same ways that the kid has been isolated. Although the professor doesn't make that connection at all, I think probably the reader will make that connection. And then the professor has secrets and lies and compartments in his life that haven't communicated with each other for his entire life, and so in a way he's a man who's shut himself away from, or has been shut away from the larger world and from the community, from his wife and from his parents and from his children. He's a detached observer. And it's quite different in that respect from the kids, who's not in the slightest detached from other people. And he sees a lot and feels a lot for other people in ways that the professor never can.
Yet you also have the professor, you put in his mouth some very interesting observations. And if I may quote from your book just a little bit here of one of them. Here he is talking to his, do you have the book there?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
In front of me.
Then I will. Here he is talking to his wife, Gloria. The professor is, and he's talking about sex offenders. He says these men are human beings, not chimpanzees or gorillas. They belong to the same species as we do. And I'm going to skip a little bit. He says, if, as it appears, the proportion of the male population who commit these acts has increased exponentially in recent years. And it's not simply because of the criminalization of the behavior and the consequent increase in the reportage of these crimes, then there's something in the wider culture itself that has changed in recent years. These men are like the canary in the mine shaft, the first among us to respond to that change. I'm going to stop there before maybe I go on a little bit. Could you comment on that a bit?
Yeah, I think what the professor's reflecting on and pointing to is a shift that he says, or he believes, took place probably starting, I think he points back to the 1950s and 60s, when children became a huge segment and eventually the largest and self-replicating segment of the consumer economy. And we started sexualizing children because sex sells. And what he means by, I think, the canaries in the mine is that the marginalized, the people who are sexually confused or who are sexually shaky in various ways, are the ones who respond most radically, perhaps, to that kind of shift in the culture. And I think he speaks elsewhere, too, about the fact that, in the past, children have always been protected from the material world in a way, from consumerism and so forth. But once you bring into the home, you know, the salesman in the form of the television, and once that becomes the babysitter, then you've essentially abandoned the children. I mean, part of that is shown in the life of the kid. The kid is himself been abandoned, but in a way that has happened to millions of kids over the last three or four generations. So I think the professor's kind of looking at it in an anthropological way, looking at our culture in an anthropological way.
Mm-hmm. And pedophiles are supposed to be driven by their own sense of inadequacy with respect to other adults. And is that why you have the professor devise a cure? Idea of the cure is by changing the pedophile's personal perception of power.
Right. He thinks it's all about power. And I'm not saying I share all the professor's perspectives or theories. He is, after all, a sociologist, and I'm just a storyteller. But he does have this theory that it's not about sex, it's about power. And we've heard that before over the last couple of generations. I mean, that's not an uncommon perspective, especially with regard to rape or sexual offenders. And so he thinks, well, if I can just find a way to give these people some sense of control and power in their lives, then that would provide them with the beginnings of a cure. And so he sets about. He's got this sort of laboratory in a way within this colony of men to work with. So he sets about trying to help them organize control over their lives and give them power over this little community, in a sense. And hoping that eventually it will, as he thinks, cure them.
What do you think of that?
What do I think of the professor's theory? I think his theory is fine. I don't think the laboratory quite. I don't think he's working with laboratory conditions particularly. He's working with a bunch of odd and eccentric and greatly varied human beings, and it's pretty difficult to apply his experiment to them. And ultimately, he does fail in his experiment. But I thought it was worth giving it a shot anyhow and seeing how far he could go with it.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with novelist Russell Banks about his acclaimed new novel, Lost Memory of Skin. He does affect, or this experiment, it seemed to me, does boost the transformation, or brings the protagonist, the kid, closer to the realization of his quest.
That's right. It does, and it gives him an ability, in a way, to see himself in a larger context, as an actor, as a person who has a very small but a very real force in the world. And in fact, when he sets out and takes control over his own life and moves out of from underneath the causeway, and ends up like Huck Finn on a raft out in the great swamp, he couldn't have conceivably done that at the beginning of the novel, at the beginning of the story. I think in that sense, with regard to the kid, the professor's theory begins to take hold. It can only go so far because of the realities of the kid's situation and the realities of the kid's life. But at least the kid is becoming aware of himself and of himself in a larger context than his immediate surroundings.
And by reality, we're saying, you know, he's wearing an ankle bracelet.
Right.
He has to recharge it every 72 hours or
That's
something
right.
like that. But it, you know, I wanted to ask you, and we're speaking with novelist Russell Banks about his latest book, Lost Memory of Skin. The kid struggles with guilt, responsibility, accountability. I'd have to say, I almost felt, I wanted to tell him, like I think some of the characters in the book do tell him, it's not your fault. But he takes very seriously the sense of taking accountability for what he has done. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, too. I mean, his crime just doesn't seem that great, and yet he seems to use it as a springboard for a deeper understanding of himself.
Yeah, the punishment doesn't fit the crime, it's true. But I think whenever that happens, no matter that the punishment doesn't fit the crime, we do feel as though, on some level, it must, or we wouldn't have been punished this way. And I think the kid is responding to that. He knows that he begins, you know, as an outsider, as someone who is not connected, as a schoolboy, to any family members. He's isolated to begin with, and when society punishes him, it seems on some level probably appropriate and necessary, and so he feels guilty, even though we know, we standing away here in the distance, we can say, well, now, come on, that punishment doesn't fit that crime. But it's legal, nonetheless, and so he has to roll with it. But I think as a character, he's a kind of self-examining, self-questioning little wise guy. His manner seems to be that, his social manner is that of a kind of defensive and deflective wise guy. But we know, because we were able to enter into his mind and his emotions, you know, thanks to the miraculous powers of fiction, we know that he's feeling, guilty and somehow he is screwed up and it's his fault and his life is a mess because he made it a mess. And so, because that's what everyone's telling him.
Yeah.
You know, from the psychiatrist that he's dealing with when he's in prison to the guys that are surrounding him, to the community as a whole.
Right.
They're all telling him the same thing. You screwed up your life.
Yeah, and so much of that is the way we do treat people in this society.
Right.
Could you, were there any great challenges? And you've written now quite a few novels. I wonder if there was anything special about this book that might have been a challenge for you in the writing of it.
Well, I think the first thing was just kind of staring down and dealing with in a unabashed way the whole question and the whole issue of sex offenders in our society, and not in any sense defending, but also not in any way judging or condemning it. I mean, I think that a novelist has to do that. You can't sentimentalize and you can't judge. You can't idealize or judge. And if you're going to see it clearly. And then this is a subject that, you know, it has a lot of taboo associated with it. It's one that we only tend to think of in terms of black or white. And we don't see... We don't humanize the people who commit these, you know, crimes, because they are crimes, and see the complexity of it and the ambiguity of so many of the aspects of it. We just wipe them aside, and that was, I think, for me the biggest task, because I'm a member of the larger community too, and I carry with me most of the same, you know, prejudices and biases and inclinations that most everybody else does. So I had to really push that aside and deal with these characters, but in particular with the kid and the men who surround him down there under the causeway, with affection and with respect.
And with deep compassion.
And with, I hope, with compassion, yes.
Yeah. Well, Russell Banks, it is just a wonderful novel.
Thank you so much.
Lost Memory of Skin, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for talking with me.
You can hear more interviews with Banks by exploring our archives at writersvoice.net. And if you're listening to Writer's Voice as a podcast and like it, please consider giving us a positive review on iTunes or any other podcast platform so you can spread the word to other listeners.
Thanks.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.